Iceworth, Dean of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies and Associate Provost for Graduate Education at McGill. And this is one of my favorite days of the year because I think it does exactly the kinds of things that Graduate Studies wants our graduate students to do, which is to be able to engage in groundbreaking research, but also to be able to communicate that research to a larger audience than just the person sitting next to them in the lab or in the library or so on. And this is something, this idea of a three-minute thesis competition is something that has been about 10 years old. It started, as far as I know, in Australia. And it gained popularity, particularly through organizations that gather universities together so that they could have competitions and give some recognition. I mean, it's not really about the competition. What it's about is gaining recognition to our graduate students' research. We all know we have great graduate students doing research. It's not always easy to find venues in which we can display that. This is one of those venues. So aside from what's going on today with our three judges and the panel today, and Fabrice will talk to you about that in a second, the winners of our competition are going to be involved in two other competitions. One is the Canadian Association of Graduate Schools, which is a group of graduate schools, 58 graduate schools in Canada that we belong to, and they have a national competition. So the winner today will be involved in that. And secondly, we also belong to a group of universities called Universitas 21, which is international. I just came from a conference, in fact, from Universitas 21. And these are universities that range across the world. There's Australia, England, Hong Kong, Shanghai, India, Europe, all over the world. And there's also a competition there. So again, the person who is successful today will be involved in that competition. Now I'd like to introduce our moderator, Professor Fabrice Lebeau. Professor Lebeau is in... I know him well, and I can't pronounce his name. Is in electrical and computer engineering, and he's also associate dean. This is in engineering for faculty affairs. He's a holder of the NSERC Hydro-Quebec chair, and he also is associate director of the Center for Advanced Systems and Technologies in Communication. Fabrice,
thank you very much, Marty. So. Welcome all of you to this event. You'll see today we have 11 presenters that have been selected from a large pool of candidates from across the university. They're going to try to present in 3 minutes how their thesis work, their research is going to change the world. They're going to talk to you about what they actually do and what the impact of what they do is. And so the whole idea is to try to communicate to a crowd that is as wide as possible the actual advances they are creating in their research. In order to judge this session today, we have three judges, and so I'll read my notes to make sure I don't forget anything to present to you all three judges. So they're sitting in front here, from my left to my right. We have Professor Olivier Dienski, who is the Deputy Provost, Student Life and Learning. He's actually a full professor of French language and literature at McGill. He's also a member of Quebec's Conseil Supérieur de l'Éducation. He's been awarded a lot of research funding as a principal investigator, nearly $3 million over the course of his career, and has lectured in Europe, United States, and Canada. As the Deputy Provost for Student Life and Learning, he basically is the central liaison for McGill between the university's senior administration, Senate, faculties, student societies, and the goal of this work is really to improve the student life and learning at all levels, be it inside or outside the classroom. Our second judge today is Dr. Madhukar Pai from the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health. He is the director of the McGill Global Health Programs and the associate director of McGill's International Tuberculosis Center. He has served in Stop TB partnership in many different roles. He's the co-chair of their working group on new diagnostics and has served as the member of their coordinating board. He serves on the editorial board of several journals, and so he is our medical kind of field representative on this panel of three judges. And finally, our third judge is Dr. Bruce Lennox from chemistry. He's the director of the ENSER Collaborative Research and Training Experience Program in neuroengineering, and he's the chair of the Chemical Institute of Canada. He was awarded the Leo Yaffe Teaching Award at McGill in 96. He's a member of the Protein Engineering Networks of Center of Excellence and of Scientific Board of Nano-Québec. He's involved in many other different endeavors related to nanotechnologies, and he will basically be the science, natural science engineering kind of representative for our panel today. So you have three judges from three very, very different backgrounds that are going to be looking at these presentations, these 11 presentations we have today. You'll have 3 minutes to go through your presentations. That's really what it is. We're not joking about it. If you go over 3 minutes, well, you're disqualified, so don't go over 3 minutes. So the judges will be evaluating the presentation based on engagement, comprehensibility, and communication. They will, at the end of this all the presentations, they will actually go and deliberate in another room. And that will be an opportunity for us here in this room to ask questions from the presenters and have a little discussion around the different presentations they've done. So that's the presentation of the event overall. Let me go directly into the presentation of our first speaker today. Our first speaker today is Danielle Dubney from Rehabilitation Science. She's a PhD student originally coming from Toronto. Her research is inspired by her clinical experience. And her favorite thing about Montreal, as she's from Toronto, is the view from Montreal, which is not surprising since her favorite book is a story about Mount Everest that is called Into Thin Air. Danielle, the floor is yours for 3 minutes.
When I was in grade school, my dad taught me the word spectrum. It's a range used to classify something in terms of its position on a scale between two opposite points. In health research, we often examine how patients feel on a spectrum. But sometimes clinicians and researchers are more interested in one end of the spectrum, often the negative. That's why my research question is, to what extent does including positive words compared to negative influence patient-reported symptoms following concussion? For a moment, let's pretend that you hit your head and I'm assessing you for a possible concussion. Here are some of the questions I would ask you. Are you sad, fatigued, confused? I think we can all agree that as you start to feel better, you will start to experience fewer of these negative symptoms. But will you also start to experience some of the positive ones, like happiness, energy, clarity? My hunch is yes, but right now, we don't ask. And yet, things like happiness, energy, and clarity might be very important for you to return to your regular activities. Let's take a concrete example that we can all understand. Fatigue. It's a symptom of concussion. Think about everything that you do in a regular day, like school, work, and being active. And think about what it's like when you don't have enough energy to do all those tasks. Were you productive? Did you get everything done? Probably not. But you'll have a good night's rest, and tomorrow you'll feel just fine. But guess what happens when you have a concussion? Your symptoms get worse, and it takes longer for you to recover. Let me put this into context for you. There are currently no tests to diagnose concussion. There is no gold standard. Despite all the other types of testing that we do, like balance, coordination, and cognition, the major contributor to assessment and return to activity decisions is patient-reported symptoms. Right now, it's the best we've got. And if it's the best, we need to be measuring it in the best way. And maybe that includes the whole spectrum. Here's where this research moves beyond concussion. Virtually every health condition is associated with some kind of symptoms. And like concussion, we focus on the negative. The way we ask questions matter. The results of this research could change the way we ask patients about their symptoms. How do you feel about that? Or should I say, how good do you feel about that?
Thank you very much. So now it's time to move to our second speaker. Our next presenter is Stephanie Bellard from Family Medicine, where she's carrying out a master degree. Her research is focused on improving the quality of life of Canadian senior citizens. She's also the research coordinator at the Donald Berman Maimonides Geriatric Center for Research in Aging, which is dedicated to studying issues affecting the geriatric long-term care population. Her research interests include screening for elder abuse and reducing unnecessary hospital transfers. Stephanie, you have 3 minutes.
I would like you to reflect for a moment on the following four words: violence, pain, neglect, silence. How would you feel if these words haunted a parent, grandparent, or friend? This is often the case for individuals suffering from elder abuse, a problem that goes undetected in an estimated 80% of cases. Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Ballard, and today I will be talking to you about elder abuse, a social phenomenon with important health implications. Elder abuse comes in many different forms. It can be physical, psychological, sexual, or financial. It can also involve neglect. Elder abuse has been associated with many negative health consequences, including depression, malnutrition, loss of quality of life, and even premature death. Elder abuse is even more concerning in long-term care institutions, where individuals are vulnerable due to their increased dependency on others. This is a problem, as it is projected that up to 750,000 Canadians will be admitted to long-term care in the next 15 years. So, what can we do? Unfortunately, elder abuse is difficult to study. Definitions, methods of reporting, and investigation standards are not common across healthcare jurisdictions. In addition, studies of elder abuse prevalence have yet to address the most vulnerable members of our society, institutionalized residents. In my thesis work, I plan to conduct a study to investigate how an existing elder abuse screening tool may be modified for use in this population. The tool is called the Elder Abuse Suspicion Index, or EASI. The EASI is comprised of 6 questions that screen for potential signs of elder abuse, but it has only been tested in elderly people living in the community and not those who are institutionalized. As such, I plan to create a long-term care version of the EASI inspired by expert panel recommendations. Then, I plan to test the use of this newly modified tool within a sample of long-term care residents. My hope is that my thesis work will enable the early detection of elder abuse in a vulnerable population. To paraphrase Abraham Joshua Heschel, a distinguished philosopher and theologian, it is easy to love children. A true test of a people is how it behaves toward the old, for this represents the true essence of a culture. My research may be one way to respect societies, and I hope your vision of what we want for our aging population. After all, everybody ages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter is also coming from Toronto originally, been living in Montreal since 2011, as I understand. His name is Elvis Chelis. He's from the Integrated Program in Neuroscience here at McGill. And apparently he has been hooked up on research since he did a science project in high school. He also enjoys the European feel of being in Montreal and spends his spare time, so apparently he does have spare time, playing chess, reading, taking online courses, riding, skating, spending time with friends. Man, you're a busy person. So, Elvis, you're next up and you have 3 minutes.
Imagine this. You're walking along with your young cousin Bobby, when all of a sudden you notice that his eyes roll up to the back of his head, he loses control of his limbs, and he slams to the ground. Bobby has just had his first seizure. What is a seizure? A seizure occurs when the normal electrical communication between cells in the brain goes into hyperactive mode. And having multiple seizures leads to the disorder that we call epilepsy. Now, epilepsy can be thought of as a sort of raging thunderstorm in the brain when there is constant electrical discharges of activity that become uncontrollable. Unfortunately, Bobby's not alone. There's more than 5 million people who suffer from epilepsy around the world. So how do we treat these people with epilepsy? Well, currently, we either prescribe anti-epileptic drugs or we perform seizures. These are two of the common methods. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, both of these treatments focus on treating the symptoms and not their underlying disorder. So how is it then that we can focus and shift our research into looking at prevention rather than treatment? This is where my thesis comes in. My name is Elvis Chella, and I'm interested in what makes the healthy brain become epileptic in the first place. How does the initial activity between cells, which allows normal cell communication, become overactive and lead to seizures? The way that we answer this is by establishing a new model of epilepsy in animals. And the way we do this is that we make a specific subpopulation of cells in the brain sensitive to light. After these cells are sensitive to light, we then use light over many days to stimulate these cells and drive them to seizures. Our model has two advantages over current models of epilepsy. The first is that using light prevents damage to the brain from actually causing the seizures. And the second advantage is that our model allows tracking and following specific cell populations in the brain. So coupled together, what we have found using our model is that when you induce seizures in the brain, once they start, they don't stop. Our research so far further suggests that this may be due to some rewiring between these specific cells which we are stimulating with light. Our next step is to investigate exactly how the rewiring is changing during seizures. And I think this is important because fundamentally, if we want to understand epilepsy, we have to understand how the disease arises in the first place. This is so we can help Bobby and the millions of sufferers around the world by preventing the disease in the first place instead of treating the symptoms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter does not come from Toronto. So Elvis Cao, who's a master's student in mining and engineering, is actually grew up in the countryside of China. He's been with us in Montreal since 2014. And apparently he loves the place and he likes the artistic side of the city, which is very nice to hear. So Elvis, you're next up and you have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My topic today is From Iron Man to Microbubbles. In the famous Marvel comics, Tony Stark has built a lot of armors which he used as Iron Man. We're all familiar with that story. But the early design of the armor was prone to icing and high altitudes. In the comics, Tony built a special alloy, gold titanium, then he solved the icing problem. Well, Tony wasn't too wrong when he chose titanium. This was actually a practical choice. Titanium is widely used in the modern aerospace industries. To increase the metal property, we can add some good elements into the metals, like what Tony did to make Iron Man. On the other hand, we also need to remove some bad elements from the metals. And that's just where the story begins for my research, using microbubbles to produce clean steel. With better mechanical properties, clean steel production is a significant issue. In the real industries, gas injection is a common practice to remove the particles. In the previous research, we know that smaller bubbles have a greater potential to attach and remove the banned elements. However, when we come to the generation of tiny bubbles, it's difficult. I'm Xiang Kun, a master's student from Mining and Materials Engineering at McGill University. In my research, the bubbles we are looking for are as tiny as the pollen grains in the micro-size range. Those bubbles are around 50 times smaller than those in real industries. In my experiments, we are creating a turbulence. Using a turbulence, we are breaking the argon gas into micro-sized bubbles. We are working tirelessly to reduce the bubble size by intensifying the turbulence intensity. Now, outside our application, in a mineral processing, these bubbles are also used for all particle flotation. These two systems look similar at first glance, but in their system, they are using a water system and room temperature back to our system in steelmaking. In a high-temperature liquid steel, it's much harder to generate micro bubbles. From Ironman to micro bubbles, these are the two ways to increase metal property. We feel the steel industry could benefit a lot from this technology, and that's the driving force behind our research. Thanks very much.
So our next presenter is Sejal Davla, who's a PhD student in the integrated program in neuroscience, again, here at McGill. He has a keen interest in politics, scientific policy making, and... Okay, well, you do have, apparently, a keen interest in politics, scientific policy making, and science journalism. It still says he. So she is passionate about scientific outreach and volunteers with BrainReach, a community outreach program, and the Alzheimer's Society of Montreal. So, and I read here that your hobbies include reading historical fiction and science nonfiction. That's very interesting. And I'm really sorry about the mispresentation there. You have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sejal, and I wouldn't be surprised if there is anybody who haven't heard of dementia, stroke, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, traumatic brain injury. Collectively, these diseases contribute to the highest disability according to the World Health Organization. In Canada alone, there are 3.6 million patients, and these numbers are going to get doubled in only 20 years. And the economic costs that we are talking about are in billion dollars. Still, we do not have highly targeted therapies. So in order to understand them, we need to look inside the brain. Our brain functions by these cables, which are called the neurons. They are essentially sending messages back and forth to each other. Now think of them as marathon runners. They are constantly running. You need helpers to give them water or energy drinks. Our brain has plenty of helpers called astrocytes, and they are reaching to the neurons with their tiny hands and giving them support. Now, one thing that happens in majority of the diseases is that the astrocytes, they lose their shape, and hence their ability to provide support to neurons. This leads to neuronal death. One strategy would be, what if you fix their shape so that the neurons will get more support, they would live longer, and you can alleviate the pain associated with the disease? Now, in my PhD thesis, I'm looking for molecules that control the shape of astrocytes using fruit fly brain. And you might want to scratch your head, why? So fruit flies are our cousins. Their astrocytes look like ours. They do same function, and they use same molecules. Most importantly, fruit flies are very cheap to maintain, very easy to grow. So for me, they are like super army. I can grow them in millions of numbers and then use them for large-scale identification of molecules. So in my PhD, I get rid of one molecule at a time from fly astrocytes and look for any changes in their shape. In this way, so far, I have identified 30 molecules that alter the shape of astrocytes. And in future, my research will tell whether putting them back into the astrocytes or using a drug to restore them can actually fix some of the symptoms of neurological disease. In closing, I want to give a take-home message. Fruit flies are very important for translational research in flies, and my PhD thesis will give us more important molecules for the neurological diseases. Thank you.
Thank you. And my apologies again. Our next presenter is the Suzanne Havelka from the School of Architecture, where she's currently pursuing a PhD. She comes to the School of Architecture with a large experience, having practiced as an architect in New York, Berlin, Prague, and Montreal here. And she basically investigates Inuit self-built houses and building systems in the Eastern Arctic. She's also involved as an educational counselor for MIT and a member of the Energy, Environment, and Sustainability Network. You have 3 minutes.
Architecture often fails. I want to talk to you about what happens when architecture fails, because what happens can be remarkable, and it can teach us about why architecture fails and what we can do about it. My name is Suzanne Havelka, and I'm an architect. 4 years ago, I visited a friend of mine in a northern Inuit community. The people there were generous and friendly. They invited me into their homes and shared with me their food. I even ate local caribou. I expected to eat caribou. What I didn't expect was to eat caribou sitting on the vinyl flooring of a house that was identical to a small bungalow in any suburban subdivision. I also didn't expect to find a community composed of cookie-cutter houses laid out along streets in a rigid linear pattern. I expected to find houses that reflected local culture and local climate, but I did not. I wondered why this was. A local resident offered me some clues. She said that up until quite recently, Inuit lived as nomadic hunters, but today almost everyone lives in towns and rented houses provided by the government. She doesn't know why all the houses look alike or why it takes almost 10 years to get a new one. She says that no one has any say in the material, placement, or even the color of his or her dwelling. So when I returned home, I was determined to learn more about why this housing was built so contrary to the lifestyle and the needs of the occupants. And I began to wonder how this resilient and resourceful people were adapting to this new built environment. So I went back to the northern community of Clyde River to find some answers. I found them in the areas in between the rows of cookie-cutter houses, in between the formal, rigid, bureaucratic. I found a remarkable hybrid architecture created by the inhabitants themselves, to answer needs never considered by the foreign designers. I found self-built porches and outbuildings that were alive with microeconomies. An entranceway could double up as a tiny sculptor's workshop. I found scarce materials recycled and repurposed, old snowmobile tracks converted into skid-proof mats. Outside, residents were continuously working on snow deflectors and skids or cabins. Look closer and you might find plexiglass and shutters designed to keep polar bears out. All these cabins had small openings in the roofs called nostrils, crucial for proper ventilation. Now, I'm not saying this architecture is ideal. It isn't. And many of the world's indigenous communities face a similar challenge. But I'll leave you with this thought. Imagine what marvelous solutions these already ingenious populations could create given the opportunity if they were the designers themselves. Thank you.
Our next presenter is Diane Hochman from the who's a law student at the Institute of Air and Space Law, who's actually coming from New Mexico, where she practiced for 2 years before coming to McGill. She also likes to, when she's not studying, and talking about airplanes and unmanned aerial vehicles, she likes to ski, explore new places, and she likes the city of Montreal. So I think this is a common theme in all our speakers today. So you have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. I want all of you to take a moment and think about all the things that you've accomplished today with the help of technology. Maybe you've used your cell phone to phone a friend, or you've ordered some books online to help your studies. Now I want you to take a moment and think about how we can improve upon these technologies. And what if I told you that in the future we can improve upon them by the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, otherwise known as drones? My name is Diane Hockman. I come from the Institute of Air and Space Law, and I'm here to tell you that the future is now. By definition, a drone is an unmanned aerial system or vehicle that is piloted either by remote control or by onboard computer systems. But really, the only thing that you need to know about drones is that anything you can do, a drone can probably do it better, and it's happening right now. We have companies like Amazon Prime Air, which are using drones to deliver packages from Amazon's warehouses to your doorstep in as little as 3 hours. Metronet Incorporated is using drone technology to deliver clean drinking water, food, and other resources to remote communities in Africa and saving children's lives. The United Nations is using drone technology to identify and disarm landmines so as to protect against loss of further human lives. Recreational drones are being bought by the thousands, and they're being used to monitor backyards or even tell you how well you're sleeping at night. We've even put drones in space. We're using them right now to monitor new satellite technology, and that's on the moon. But just like any other groundbreaking technology before drones that have been able to change the trajectory of history, there are some serious problems. And some of them that we've identified have not to do with the operations of drones, but how we're going to legalize and regulate something that has the potential to be so big and so ubiquitous that it could have the power to eclipse, or as some experts say, to eclipse the use of the automobile from 3 to 1. So, other than operational difficulties, really the threats are against personal privacy rights and safety. What are we going to do when we look out the window and we see an unauthorized drone taking pictures of yourself or your children without your permission? What are you going to do when you're stuck on a flight at the airport and you can't go anywhere for hours because of unauthorized drone traffic in the sky? A lot of international communities have been asking these questions, and they've come up with answers in a variety of ways. How are we going to regulate drones? Are we going to regulate them the same way we regulate unusual manned aircraft? How are we going to train drone pilots? Are we going to treat them the same way? Are recreational drones going to be treated the same way as commercial drones? How are we going to protect the immense economic opportunities that drone technology will afford us while simultaneously protecting the privacy rights and the safety of everyone else on the ground? My research is about asking and answering these important questions, and it's my hope that it will be used by companies, governments all over the world to come up with a concise international regulatory scheme for unmanned aerial systems so that this technology, drone technology, something that has the power and the potential to really change the world, can do so in a productive and positive way. Thank you.
Thank you. So our next speaker is going to be Pierre Lubin, who is in educational studies, and he was born in Haiti. Then he moved on to Brooklyn, New York, served in the U.S. Marine Corps, but now he's concentrating on contributing to policy in the education space to improve the quality of education in Haiti. So Pierre, the floor is yours.
I'm mute, but only when I'm in school. Welcome to the reality of the vast majority of Haitian students. Good afternoon, my name is Pierre Lubin, and I'm here to tell you about an unjust practice that kills the hopes and dreams of so many Haitians. Afraid of being ridiculed, ostracized, and punished, an untold number of Haitian students practice selective mutism only when they're in school, like I did when I was a schoolboy in Haiti. Day in and day out, the majority of Haitian students sit in classrooms where the language of instruction is French, a language that only 10% of Haitian students speak, and 80% of Haitian teachers lack competence in. What kind of game is this? It's called elite closure. That is, in order for the Haitian elite to preserve their powers and privileges, as a strategy, they made French the language to access the halls of power. This means that 95% of Haitians whose language is Creole can't play the game. The game plays them. In my mixed method study, I am currently analyzing both qualitative and quantitative data. Thus far, the data confirms that what more than 50 years of research has shown, that students learn best when the language of instruction is a language that they are competent in. I want to conclude by saying that I am a firm believer that one should learn as many languages as one possibly can. Myself, I speak three languages, and French is one of them. However, I am adamantly against the practice of teaching students in a language that they neither speak nor understand. I want to smash that game. And my research at McGill University is all about that. It seeks to influence educational policy in order to give so many Haitians their voices back so that they can dream and hope again, like me. I thank you kindly for your patience and kindness.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter is Ralina Thomas, who's coming also from Ontario, but London, Ontario. She's a PhD student in neuroscience, and she is currently volunteering a lot with different organizations who try to introduce children grades 5 to 6 to neuroscience. And she interacts a lot with the students there, and she finds that it is a very enlightening experience, apparently. So the floor is yours, and you have 3 minutes.
Sorry. Hello, my name is Ralina Thomas. Many of you may remember recently in the news, Brian Williams was disgraced by telling a false story of being shot down in a helicopter while reporting in Iraq. A soldier present at this incident revealed that Williams was part of a convoy, and it was in fact the helicopter ahead of his that faced RPG fire. He apologized and claimed that he had misremembered the event. This was widely met with skepticism. Critics claim he purposely exaggerated this story. How could somebody misremember such a dramatic event? Let's look at this through the lens of neuroscience. How do we make memories? How are memories formed? We don't yet understand this completely. What we do believe is that memories are made and stored at synapses. Synapses are the site of chemical communication between two neurons in your brain. When we grow from an infant to an adult, we are constantly adding and removing new synapses. When we receive input from the environment outside of us, our synapses are altered. On the diagram, you can see a drawing of a neuron, and we zoom in to see the synapses. We receive input, and synaptic plasticity occurs. That's the changing of the synapses. Neuroscientists believe that synaptic plasticity underlies learning and memory. Many of the molecules involved in these processes are known, but many more are yet to be discovered. We don't understand which synapses are saved and which are removed, and how this translates into memory formation. One molecule recently identified is called NGR1. This molecule activates what we call a signaling cascade, which is where one protein activates another protein, much like firemen passing a water bucket in a fire brigade. If we imagine the synapse as a hot air balloon, NGR1 initiates the fire brigade, turning out the fire, causing the hot air balloon to collapse, and thus the synapse is removed. In my thesis, I show this protein, LGI1, physically blocks NGR1 from functioning. The water is not turned on, the fire remains on and the hot air balloon remains open, or the synapse remains intact. The interaction of these molecules could be one mechanism by which memory formation occurs. Now, how does this relate to Brian Williams? If we keep in mind that every time you remember a story, a new copy of this memory is saved. So each time your synapses are changing. It is pointed out in the media that Williams changed his story slowly over time. So it is not so preposterous that he saved a new copy. His memory evolved, and he truly did misremember the event. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mohamed Ousmane from Civil Engineering. He's pursuing graduate studies as a master's student in civil engineering, and he's drawing the motivation for that from the earthquake that ravaged parts of Pakistan in 2005, and basically the reason why he says he's pursuing studies in civil engineering now is to try and build structures that will stand the test of time, which is a very noble way into engineering. So that's really well to be recognized. The other thing I note here in his biography is that he's another international student or non-local to Montreal who likes Montreal. So again, it's very welcome to hear that. You have 3 minutes to convince us.
Did you know that a total of 3 to 4 million people are estimated to die during earthquakes in the coming century? Now that's twice the more population of Montreal currently. Now why is that? The problem isn't just the frequency of earthquakes or their magnitude, but it's the population density which matters most these days. Consider the exponential growth of already populated cities. The loss of life under each roof in such case is so much more. The poor design and malconstruction practices across the globe are one of the key factors that make structures highly vulnerable to such risks. Without the seismic control construction in earthquake hazard zones, the number of catastrophic events and fatalities will continue to increase, and our predictions are likely to be fulfilled. I am Mohamed Bleed Ousmane, a master's student at McGill, and my research aimed in finding a solution to this very problem by conducting seismic vulnerability assessment. Now, for this assessment, in order to obtain universally applicable results, 3 major things were done. First, the critical ground motion data for former earthquakes were used. And then, 25,000 samples of concrete and steel were obtained from commercial testing labs. And finally, the analysis and simulations of over 800 reinforced concrete frame structures were performed by varying multiple building and material parameters. And finally, the vulnerability curves were the outcome of this research study. This curve is a plot of intensity of earthquake versus damage level in percentage of a building structure. If we have a given level of earthquake, we can determine the damage that will occur to the structure for any specific area and moreover for any specific seismic zone. This one curve, which is a key component of earthquake risk assessment, has many practical applications. This curve can help you save millions of dollars in terms of investment by estimating the damage before the actual disaster could occur. These curves can be used by the banks and other financial institutions by determining specific insurance premium required. Disaster management authorities can use these curves for quick emergency response and post-disaster relief operations. And we, structural engineers, can use them for structural repairs and rehabilitation. Earthquakes aren't fatal. It's our own handiwork that does the job. Who knew that our own creation would haunt us in days to come? Now, I designed these curves for my home country, Pakistan, which is the 6th most populated state in the world. If my work can shelter 180 million fellow residents of my country, surely we can project the same vision beyond the border. Look at these kids. You can feel the helplessness, the anguish. We cannot put a price on human life, and working for the safety for 7 billion people of my planet is no longer a choice. It's an obligation, and it all begins with this one curve. I thank you all.
So thank you. Our last presenter today is the Xufeng Zhao, a PhD student in experimental surgery. She comes from a small village in China, and she moved to Canada after studying at the Sun Yat-sen Medical University close to Hong Kong. She is passionate about cancer research, and so I assume that's what you're going to talk about today, enjoying science fiction, learning English and French, and jogging. You have 3 minutes.
Do you remember Jack Layton, the beloved Canadian politician? He suffered from prostate cancer that spread over to his other organs. It is this cancer spread, known as metastasis, that killed him. This is the worst-case scenario for cancer patients. Indeed, metastatic cancer kills millions of people every year. The goal of my PhD study is to find a way to stop cancer spread. Good afternoon, my name is Xufeng, a PhD student from experimental surgery. Now, let's picture cancer like weeds invading your garden. In order to get rid of the weeds, you cannot just tear off the visible parts, but have to remove the roots and the seeds. This should be the same principle for cancer treatment. Not only must remove the tumor mass, but also to kill the cancer cells that initiate the tumors. Unfortunately, current cancer therapy only kill the cancer cells that grow fast, but not the one that drive the tumors. In fact, solid tumor can shed cancer cells into the bloodstream that we call circulating tumor cells. These cancer cells can act like seeds, spread cancer. More importantly, they can act like seeds to spread cancer. More importantly, they can remain inactive for years in your body, then suddenly spread cancer all over when your immune system goes down. In order to invade your body, this cancer spread seeds exploit a process called apicillin to mesenchymal transition that required for normal wound healing. Moreover, a molecule named TGF-beta can promote this process, act like a fertilizer to boost the cancer cells spread. However, there is good news. Our lab discovered a new TGF-beta inhibitor that can counteract its infection, make the fertilizer less effective to promote a cancer spread. During my PhD, I will look at this inhibitor to see how it can be used as a therapeutic agent to fight against cancer. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to my PhD supervisor, Dr. Annie Philip.
So thank you for your presentation, and thanks to all our speakers today. Now it is time for our three judges to disappear in a secret room somewhere to deliberate. And when they reappear, they will be able to announce the two candidates who have been selected to go to the Canadian Association of Grad Studies Eastern Regional Final, and also who is going to be representing McGill on the U21 virtual three-minute thesis challenge. So, for now, while our judges are deliberating, now it's question time. So I would like to ask all our presenters to come back here up front, and we'll be able to hear all the questions that your presentations have created in the mind of the audience. Come closer here. Okay, be in front here, and I'm just going to move out of the way. So, are there any questions from the audience that are burning right now? And I'm just going to bring to you the microphone.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the epilepsy. Can you say something about, is it hereditary, the genetics behind epilepsy?
So your question is it hereditary?
Yeah.
Yes, there are strains of mice that actually people use to study the genetic sort of variants of epilepsy. So once they have a gene mutated, these animals will begin developing epilepsy at a certain age, and they will essentially, you don't have to do anything, they will develop it by themselves. The reason we don't use that is because that sort of, the brain there is not healthy to begin with. So if you do any manipulations, essentially what you're doing is you're sort of doing a second mutation or a second hit on the already unhealthy brain. So it's difficult to try to distinguish these effects.
Other questions? No volunteers? The microphone?
So if we don't have any questions that are burning right now from the audience, I'd like to ask you a collective questions. Why are you doing this? So it's a lot of work. It's basically putting yourself in front of an audience and being judged. So what is the motivation for you to participate in this kind of challenge?
Well, I think it's important for all advanced graduate degree students to know how to speak in front of an audience. For a lot of us, our research depends on grant money and goals, and sometimes in order to get access to that money, you have to speak to the public, you have to present your project, you have to know what you're talking about, and you have to do it in a pretty eloquent manner. So for me, it was a free opportunity to practice that and also kind of talk about stuff that I think is really cool. So.
Any other takers?
So there would be many people here who are from science background, and lots of them would be doing basic research like me. And there's lots of clamor going on around in North America, and it's spreading that what are you contributing by your research to public health? And I think I took this opportunity to talk about my project in the sense that it's something that we do out of curiosity, but it's not that it doesn't have its application. And again, the take home is that just because you are working with some organisms that are tiny and non-important in your eyes can actually contribute a lot to our own lives. So that's why I chose to speak here. Thank you.
Because I'm doing this, because every day I saw people dying from cancer. So I think for me, most of the time I spend in the lab, 10 hours, 12 hours, 18 hours to do experimental. But finally we realize we're short of funding. In order for the research to continually go on, we have to raise the funding. So I hope to take this chance to talk to people and then ask people maybe to do some donation for funding cancer research.
Like my colleague, I also do basic research, and there's a lot of talk among neuroscientists of why do we have to justify ourselves to the public. And I believe that we do have to justify why is our research important, and I also think community outreach for science is really important. And I think the reason why we get, I would say, slightly offended when people ask us, well, what's the importance of your project, is because it's difficult to communicate. It's a hard question to answer because it is very technical to explain concepts in science, but it's not impossible. It just takes a little bit of time. So I wanted to challenge myself to try to explain some of my research in a way that would be accessible to the public and to justify basic research.
Hi, thank you very much for the opportunity. There might be like two reasons for me, one of which is like, I'll second your opinion that, I mean, public needs to know that what's going on inside the campus. I mean, like we are coming by wearing like bags, stuff with laptops and stuff like that, and working day and night and doing nothing. And they would be like, hey, what do you do? Yeah, we are doing research and some stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, because such platforms provide you opportunity to make their life simple by telling them story in just 3 minutes or something like that. And another one is like, there were like two talks before in 2013, 2014 also. And luckily I am the second engineer who have come over here. And even the first one was from medical side. He was a biomedical engineer. So yeah, so like that was also a driving opportunity to like say, tell the people that there is also research going on, civil engineering, and also the structure stuff. Yeah.
Well, before these 3-minute things existed,
we had a kind of different attitude. I remember many years ago when I was doing my PhD, I had a very good supervisor, and he told me that, you know, because we would write things for grants, and I still did that in those days too, and other things would go on, but he was a big believer in communicating your research publicly. But his attitude, and I still think it makes sense, was to say, if you're doing research that is important to you and important to other people, you should be able to tell your great aunt sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner what you're doing. And if you can't do that, you clearly don't know what you're doing. So, I mean, there is a fundamental sense that you should be able to put that. Now, that kind of is the same thing as the three-minute. I don't know, we don't, you know, maybe you don't envision us all as your great aunts, but, you know, it's a similar position we're in terms of the knowledge that we have. I do have a specific question for a couple of you, but one, I'm fascinated by the architecture issue because you wonder how, I mean, I won't get into the policy questions, how they ever developed these kind of architecture to begin with. But I must say I'm watching this series on TV now called Fortitude. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's kind of a BBC Norwegian thing, but it's about this place way up north. It's the same thing. I was surprised to see that the community that they built up there, it looks exactly, you could go to a suburb anywhere, and that's exactly what it looks like. And it doesn't seem appropriate for the landscape or anything else. So despite that issue, which, you know, is essentially political and has other things, how can you take those kinds of individual decision-making about designs that are given by the population itself and translate into something that is going to be useful and is going to be something that will sustain? What I mean is I'm a little worried, and I'm sure you know the details, that in a year somebody from the government is going to come and tear those buildings down, and they're going to be stuck back with the same houses that they had to begin with.
I think the answer is really through Inuit. Inuit have to come together and decide on how they want to educate their populations in order to be able to design and build their own houses. I think Canada is the last circumpolar region that doesn't have a university. Alaska, Norway, Greenland, everybody does have one. And they have to come up with a formula of a kind of rural type university, an Arctic university that allows them to, you know, to train in fields that would allow them to design and build their own housing. I showed the slide, building housing that is clearly sophisticated and clearly incorporating design principles that are both traditional but using materials and technologies and tools that are really quite modern. So there's this hybrid really, you know, happening. And I think they're ingenious, and I'm completely in awe with the creativity and the initiatives and the energy, and I think they're coming back.
Any other questions coming from the audience right now? No? Okay, you can go for another one if you have another one. It's up to you. Okay.
In terms of the elder abuse, yeah, you know, we're all kind of upset when we hear about these kinds of things. And how do you see will change be? You know, we're always concerned about how our research then gets translated. Not all of us. Some of us do kind of very pure research that's going to have very little translatability, at least now, into something, but in research that seems to have some effect on the world, how might your research be used to, you know, actually get change in government? I mean, what's the next step? Do you work on policy issues? Because you can do some great research and then nobody listens to it in terms of the people that can make a change.
Right, exactly. So the person who I'm working with, Dr. Mark Yaffe, is the developer of the EASY, the tool that I was discussing in my talk. And he gets emails every day from people in institutions asking him, okay, this is great. You made this tool that we use in the community in our own patient practices. But what do we do when these patients are institutionalized? We have nothing, you know, to detect elder abuse in these people. And the tool, as it stands right now, can't do that. It can't be used in these situations. And people are asking him for it. So together, him and I are trying to find something that we can give to these people for them to implement right away. And if I don't finish it in my master's, perhaps it'll be something that will fuel a PhD later on. But it's definitely a tool that can be printed and disseminated to doctors or nurses or even the residents or patients themselves. So
it's partly the question of just adaptability. So exactly. Once the community of practice adopts it, then it becomes something that becomes a standard.
Right. So then it becomes given to medical students, for example, or nursing students, and they're told to use this tool in cases where they think it would be relevant. Okay. So,
actually, the same question in terms of the language study in Haiti. So it seems counterintuitive that that one would want to train people. I know it's not counterintuitive because it happens all over the world, but that one would want to train a population in a language that not only do the participants who are at the schools, the students don't know, but the teachers also don't know well enough. And where's the breakdown? I mean, I know it sounds like you were expressing that the breakdown essentially is the power differential between the people who are in charge of the educational system and the people who actually take advantage of the educational system. And how does research change that, I guess, is my question.
You highlight a conflict here. And certainly there are different ways, different approaches that one can attempt to resolve conflict. We can go maybe, unfortunately, for far too long, the method of the approach of trying to resolve that conflict has been one, if you will, avoid the conflict. And some have even taken the approach of the competitive approach. And that, too, is to no avail. Myself, what I think the ideal approach is the collaborative approach, to show that it can be a win-win situation. Certainly, if we look at it's not the aftermath of, let's say, serendipity, why Haiti, for example, has the worst economy in the Americas. And it's because of this problem. Clearly, there is a strong link between education and economic growth. And as a result, because of this, if you will, draconian practice, we have that situation that obtains. And so my research, it's also about trying to influence educational policies, but using a collaborative approach so that it's clearly understood by the different stakeholders that it's at the end of the day, everybody wins.
So have you actually started getting Creole being the language of teaching in some schools?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then you can test differences once you have that.
Absolutely. In fact, I work with teachers, I work with policymakers, as well as the policy elites in Haiti. And so my approach, I think you get more mileage, you get more out of it when the approach is a collaborative win-win. It calls for finding creative solution. And I think in the long term, it's more beneficial. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you kindly.
I have a question also for the education in Haiti.
Oh, okay. Back to the podium.
Back to the podium. my curiosity with the, let's say, even like the conflict within the teachers to have to teach in a language that they don't know, how that influences their class management and the relationship between teacher and student, how that affects the selective mutism. Not mutism, is that it?
Yes, yeah, selective mutism on the part of the patient
on the part
students.
I'm curious about the effect of, let's say, the emotional state within the classroom that would feed into the select mutism, and then how that changes within the classrooms that are forced French and the classrooms that are that have the openness for Creole.
Well, that's a very excellent question, and I do explore that in my study, and I do have the opportunity to juxtapose, if you will, various different classroom configurations. And so what I am seeing, it's either, in terms of behavior management, it's either it's mayhem, total chaos, or I've literally visited, observed certain classrooms where for an hour, not one student said a word. Yeah. That's inherently problematic. Yeah. Yeah.
So I have a question about the fruit flies. Well, I found it very interesting that we can use fruit flies because I personally dislike them so much. So I'd like to get a little bit more details about how they can help us. So if you can, please.
Yeah, so it's the fruit fly season. They'll don't leave your bananas in the kitchen outside. So the fruit fly history in research goes back to 100 years. And it's, again, this funny thing, you know. This one person, Thomas Hunt Morgan, he was at Columbia working in his lab. And then these fruit flies, they just keep flooding in his lab. So what he does is he takes like a bottle and then like makes a trap so that, you know, they just get in there and then he can throw it away. So he did that. And one thing that found is that they look different, you know. Like we just assume that they're flies normally. Okay, just get into specific, let's say, for example, they should have red eyes. And then he was looking, it's like, oh, but some of them are white eyes, you know, why is that? And he was a geneticist by profession. So then he thought, is it something to do with genes? And this is 100 years back. And all that he did was, you know, take out these flies, looked at their genes, and then found that there's actually a mutation that causes that. Now, just by this discovery, there are many people doing in cancer research, neurosciences, any disease that you can think of, they are using fruit flies for the simple reason that the genes that make fruit flies, they are pretty much similar to our genes. So what you can do is if you find a gene, you can very easily translate it to the human gene and then look for function. And the best thing is that it's cheap, you know, that you can grow them like hundreds of fly in these tiny bottles. They are non-invasive, they are not going to harm you, and it's very easy to do, and that's the reason that people are using fruit flies for their research. Yeah.
Are there any additional questions for our many presenters here? They're ready and waiting. So if you don't have any additional questions, I have here something that looks like the results because the judges are back. And so we have to announce two winners. We have two representatives. One is going to go to the CAGS Eastern Regional final, and another one is going to represent McGinn in the U21 virtual 3-minute talk challenge. So the winner for the CAGS representation is Muhammad Usman from Civil Engineering. So, Mari, you want to give the gift back to Muhammad.
Congratulations again.
Oh, you have another one.
Yes. Oh, let me look through.
Let me look through this then. There's another prize somewhere. So, the person who's the other winner, who's going to represent McGill at the Universitas 21 competition, is Sejal Davla. So you see, fruit flies. People like fruit flies in the end.
Nice.
You managed. Congratulations to both of you. Congratulations to all of you for doing this, because I'm still personally very much convinced that the best things we do in this university is educate students. And the research we do is through you, and your research is what gets out in the world. Right now, you are our ambassadors. You know how to convey the right message about why it is that you do the things you do and why the things you do are so cool and interesting. So Thank you very much to all of you for participating. It was a really, really nice event. It was a pleasure to listen to all of you. And congratulations to our two winners. Thank you. So one of our judges wants to say a word. So the judges will want to give you some feedback. So if you want to stick around, maybe you want to do that live. So do you want to do that generically now, or do you want to do? It's up to you.
Okay. So again, guys, congratulations. Just some generic advice. So I know you tend to be tense and watching the clock and all of that. A couple of you did go over time, unfortunately. So watch the clock and make sure that you are, maybe have your phone on with your stopwatch on. Secondly, none of you genuinely tried to engage with the audience, right? So you could have polled people or made them laugh or start off with something that would have really gotten people a lot more engaged in the work you were doing. As some of my colleagues mentioned, that some of you put the slide on but didn't really connect us to what was going on or trying to bring us back to what. But I think the most important feedback that we all felt was what we really wanted to see was the results of your work. You have a great idea, but the proposal by itself, honestly, you can't really judge. We don't know whether your idea is changing the world. Is your research results changing the world, right? So this is something for Elisa and us to discuss as well. I think the most exciting thing is to say, look, we did this, we found this, and we think this has the potential to change the world beyond just a hypothesis. Right? So please emphasize the results of your work. Don't spend all your time on introduction and background and not even spend a second or two on what really matters, right? What did you actually find? So for you, Usman, for example, if I were to give your talk, your slide was nice, but show us the curve for Bangladesh. Tell us how many million people will be affected by the earthquake if it was 8.1 or 8.2. Show us the actual results. The curve that you cared so much about was not on your slide, right? So when you go to the next round, think about how you can actually show the results. That, to me, is the punchline, and that's exactly what all of us felt. So some of you had great ideas, but really no results there for us to really anchor our judging criteria against. Is that okay? Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. So you've had feedback, you've had congratulations. I think you all deserve congratulations. Thank you again for all the work you've put into this. That will bring this event to a conclusion. Stick around, we'll take a group picture in a few minutes. Thank you everybody for attending. Thank you for everybody online who watched the live streaming. Thank you very much. Have a great end of the day.